Penguin Random House Audio presents Britain at Bay, the epic story of the Second World War, 1938 to 1941, by Alan Allport. Read for you by James Langton. Deo gratias Anglia rede pro victoria. Dedicated to the 15 passengers and crew members of the steam merchant Alfaka, who died when she was torpedoed off Cape Palmas, Liberia, on 4 April 1942. Foreword. This book, the first of two parts, is an attempt to understand how Britain fought the Second World War, how it became involved in it in the first place, how it fought it, why it was ultimately on the winning side, and what the war did to its institutions, its culture, and its society. It is a version of the story that omits the well-loved but misleading clichés that have traditionally infused it. In doing this, it becomes a story that is more interesting, more valuable, more important than ever. Britain's war can be understood broadly as a tale of two parts. The first part, which this volume is concerned with, is a story mostly about defeat. Diplomatic defeat, followed by military defeat after military defeat. What it tries to explain is how a country that got so many things catastrophically wrong in the early years of the conflict managed not just to hold out against Hitler, but, by the second anniversary of the war's outbreak in September 1941, to have apparently halted the rout, and even perhaps to be constructing a plausible theory of victory. It ends on a note of cautious hope. The second part will show how such hopes eventually became realities, and how the British people rallied themselves as part of a powerful global alliance to defeat Nazism, fascism, and Japanese militarism, and what the cost of that victory would turn out in the end to be. A note on money. Throughout the period discussed in this book, the currency system used in the United Kingdom was based on pounds, shillings, and pence, written as, for example, £3, 10 shillings, 6 pence. There were 12 pence in a shilling and 20 shillings in a pound. After Britain abandoned the gold standard in 1931, the exchange rate between the pound and US dollar fluctuated for the rest of the decade. Between 1934 and 1938, £1 averaged around $5. Balance of payment pressures in the final year of peace owing to rearmament saw the pound fall to $4.60, and at the outbreak of war in September 1939, it briefly reached a low of $3.99. In March 1940, the pound was pegged at $4.03, and it remained at that fixed rate until it was devalued in 1949. It is impossible to apply a one-size-fits-all conversion of 1930s and 1940s wages and prices into modern terms, because the costs of goods and services have inflated at different rates in the intervening years. As a rough guide, a male manual worker in 1938 might have expected to earn about £3.10 a week, working an average 48 hours. A woman's pay was typically half that of a man. Working-class wages rose significantly during the war, but so also did the cost of living, cancelling out to some extent the benefit. Middle-class income was calculated in terms of annual salary rather than weekly earnings. An annual salary over £250 excluded the recipient from participation in the National Unemployment Insurance Scheme, and was regarded in the 1930s as a benchmark dividing the working and middle classes. A senior white-collar worker, for example the branch manager of an important regional office, might earn £1,000 a year or more. A newly built terraced house in the London area cost about £400 in the mid-1930s. The same house in 2020 would cost around £800,000. To get a sense of how state expenditure translates into modern terms, compare the United Kingdom's total central government spending in 1935 of £732 million with the 2020 figure of £667 billion, 911 times greater. It can also be useful to consider cost in terms of function. The unit cost of a Supermarine Spitfire Mark I in the late 1930s was around £9,500. The unit cost of the combat aircraft that performs the same role for the RAF today, the Eurofighter Typhoon, is approximately £110 million, or 11,500 times greater. Part 1. The British Way and Purpose. 1. Shire Folk. In November 1949, Major Warren Lewis, brother of C.S. Lewis, wrote what was probably the first ever review of J.R.R. Tolkien's novel, The Lord of the Rings. The manuscript he had read was in an inchoate state. It did not even have a title. But this New Hobbit, the long-awaited sequel to Tolkien's 1937 children's story of that name, had captivated Lewis immediately. Golly, what a book! The inexhaustible fertility of the man's imagination amazes me, Lewis enthused in his diary. He was struck by Tolkien's mastery of description, his poignant characterizations, and the unflagging energy of the narrative. This, he felt, was a great book of its kind. Lewis wondered, though, if critics would interpret The Lord of the Rings as a political satire about contemporary Europe, rather than as the timeless, mythopoeic fantasy that Tolkien had intended to write. By accident, a great deal of it can be read topically, Lewis thought, the Shire standing for England, Rohan for France, Gondor, the Germany of the future, Sauron for Stalin. He even wondered if the egregious Lewis Silkin, the Minister of Town and Country Planning in Clement Attlee's Labour government, would be identified as the vandal wizard Saruman, destroyer of the novel's pastoral idyll, the Shire. None of this would have pleased Tolkien. In 1965, in the foreword to the second edition of The Lord of the Rings, he explicitly rejected the idea that his story was intended as an allegory of any historical event, most of all the recent Great War against Nazism. The real war does not resemble the legendary war in its process or its conclusion, Tolkien insisted. Even so, for all such protestations, Lewis had clearly been onto something back in 1949. He had realized that Tolkien's future audience was going to see associations between events in Middle-earth and those in their own world. But then Tolkien himself, in his 1965 foreword, conceded that the absence of any deliberately embedded allegory did not preclude his readers' right to interpret the text as they saw fit. The Lord of the Rings might not serve as an allegory, but it had what he called applicability. Tolkien had, after all, never made any secret of the fact that the Shire, the setting of the first four and final two chapters of The Lord of the Rings, was modelled on the rural Warwickshire he half-remembered from his childhood in the 1890s. Even the Shire's location, on the northwestern edge of Middle-earth, correlated with the usual placement of the British Isles on the map of Europe. The Shire, with its dry stone walls, hay wains, country ale houses, and sheriffs, was an affectionate parody of the pre-industrial deep England, already central to conservative, especially Catholic conservative, conceptions of English identity at the beginning of the 20th century through the writings of authors such as G.K. Chesterton, H.J. Massingham, and H.V. Morton. And the Shire's diminutive inhabitants, hobbits, charming, absurd, helpless hobbits, as Gandalf the Wizard calls them, corresponded very neatly with the gentle and unassuming self-image that the English people had adopted for themselves in the years after the First World War. They had not always seen themselves as such meek creatures. The brash, bumptious ogre John Bull, the personification of English virtues, who had symbolized the age of High Britannic imperialism and gunboat diplomacy, was no hobbit. But, after the slaughter of the Western Front, the English were weary of John Bull's aggressive theatricality. Now they saw themselves exemplified by the little man, small, kindly, bewildered, modest, obstinate, and very lovable, as the right
sample complete. Ready to continue?